Ross Holkerbeck here on behalf of Patrick Bircher.
Okay, and Mr. Holkerbeck, have you received the instructions from this court about oral argument?
I believe I have, yes.
Do you have any questions about those?
No, sir.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, because you weren't here when I asked Mr. Holm that same question.
It would have been earlier.
Earlier today.
Okay.
Before you came.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Are you ready to proceed, sir?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. Well, let's go then.
All right. May it please the court. Afternoon. I want to talk today about two issues, the first being the trial court's use of the inevitable disclosure theory of trade secret misappropriation to infer trade secret misappropriation by my client. And then the second issue being the scope of the trial court's injunction and whether, as we contend, that was overly broad and vague. So the first issue is whether Colorado recognizes the inevitable disclosure theory of trade secret misappropriation. And that's the theory that if an employee knows his employer's trade secrets and then leaves to go into direct competition with the employer, that it's permissible to infer that the employee inevitably will either disclose or use the trade secrets to compete.
Mr. Polkrobeck, before you go into that, would you please address your opponent's argument that that concept played very little role in the trial court's order, and that the trial court's order was instead based on established Colorado law?
Okay, I'm happy to address that. Throughout the course of this case, inevitable disclosure was always in play from the beginning when TAG moved for a preliminary injunction, and at the preliminary injunction hearing discussed the PepsiCo case, which is the seminal case on inevitable disclosure at length. And the trial court then adopted the PepsiCo case in its ruling at the preliminary injunction phase. And then again at trial when TAG argued that the trial court should infer that Mr. Bircher had misappropriated trade secrets because he had them in his head and because he went directly into competition with TAG. That was always the inevitable disclosure theory in play. The only
when the court was talking about inferring things, didn't they specifically say that they could infer that he had misappropriated the secrets because he actually used forms that were similar, he used processes that were similar, and his finished product was similar to that which the assist group used. So it wasn't just a matter of inferring that he might do it. Didn't the court find he actually did it?
Well, no, I don't think that the court did reach that finding. The court's language was that the trial court believed it was fair to infer that because he had the trade secrets in his head, that he must have misappropriated. And I would direct this court to the trial court's order on page 14 of the June 30th transcript, where the judge says, I think it's completely appropriate for the court to infer that when he leaves TAG and starts a new business within a few days, goes to a new business over the weekend, creates a perspective identifying what the business will do, what that business will do, which is substantially the same as the assist group. In other words, direct competition, I think, is what the court's talking about there. Uses forms that are similar, substantially the same as the assist group. He's using the processes he used. The forms that the assist group raised was there was an Exhibit N, which is a form that TAG uses to market its product and gives to hospitals, and is not considered a trade secret. I think that's what the form was that TAG's witness talked about as being similar to the form that Mr. Bircher used. And I think the inference that one can draw from that is that there was direct competition going on between Mr. Bircher and TAG. There's no dispute there. But as TAG's own CEO testified consistently, the things that are shown on that form, which are the kinds of things that TAG reviews the bills for, whether there's billing errors, double billing of say, a heart monitor being billed twice, improper unbundling of charges, which would be when tests should be done as a panel and instead they're charged separately, all those different things that would be shown on TAG's Exhibit N.
those aren't trade secrets. Everybody knows in the industry that those are the things that are being looked at whenever anybody's scrutinizing a hospital bill. The trade secret, according to TAG's owner, is in the details. And there's been no evidence that Mr. Bircher was using the details of TAG's system. And that's why, in this case, TAG was never able to say, here's what we contend to be a trade secret, and here's where it matches up in things that Mr. Bircher was doing when he was competing with us. Here's where he used this trade secret or this bundle of trade secrets. That evidence was not presented, and the trial court here never found Mr. Bircher used this particular trade secret in his post-competition employment.
Does the court need to do that? I mean, I don't think you dispute that there were these processes were trade secrets, correct?
We agree that there are trade secrets.
Right.
Yes.
And that these particular processes that were developed over a number of years were trade secrets, correct?
Correct.
Right. So you read the portion of the transcript. I'm looking at it too. I mean, the court says he leaves, he starts a new business. Within a few days, he kind of lands the biggest major client of the other side. He seems to be doing the same stuff, et cetera. And the court infers from that he is using the processes that he used at the assist group. Why isn't that a finding that, as Judge Nieto said, that he did misappropriate the process? Did he have to use magic words like he's and I'm not being facetious, I'm asking you, did he have to say he misappropriated this particular secret process?
Well, there were all sorts of trade secrets that were discussed at trial, from TAG's proprietary hands software system, a Microsoft triage form that had built-in logic, various things that they called their forensic review exception guidelines that kind of went through, if you run into this particular situation on a bill, here's how you analyze it, so on and so forth. All of those things, we agree, are trade secrets. There's just no evidence that Mr. Bircher used any of those things. And to say that because he knew TAG's trade secrets from having worked there for several years, one can infer that he must be using them when he goes into competition, I think is false reasoning. It certainly shows that he is competing with TAG, but you can't infer that somebody's using a trade secret merely because they go into competition. The Colorado, let me approach this from a different angle. The Colorado General Assembly has chosen how it wants to address the very issue that I think TAG and other employees would raise, which is, how can we have assurance that when one of our employees who knows our trade secrets leaves isn't going to use our trade secrets in competition? The way that the General Assembly has addressed that issue is by allowing for covenants not to compete that are designed to protect trade secrets. And in that situation, of course, we all know that the covenant not to compete has to be narrowly tailored and limited in time. But that gives the employer assurance that for some period of time after the employee leaves, there will not be use of their trade secrets. And they don't have to prove that there actually will be misappropriation of trade secrets in that situation. But here, by inferring that there would be misappropriation of trade secrets, it's an end run around the way that the Colorado General Assembly has chosen to address this problem. It gets away with the need for any covenant not to compete. And indeed, in this case, the trial court found that there was no covenant not to compete between Mr. Bircher and TAG.
I guess I'm a little stumped on the evidence. What evidence do you think they should have put on? I mean, was this a matter of deposing your client and say, what process did you follow? Well, I mean, so I guess two questions for you. What evidence do you think was missing? Because as you well know, in these cases, they often rely on circumstantial evidence. And then I'd be curious, what evidence came out? What exactly did your client say he did?
Well, there are three ways that trade secret misappropriation can be used: improper acquisition of the trade secret, improper disclosure to a third party, or improper use. TAG stipulates that there's no evidence that Mr. Bircher improperly acquired the trade secret. In fact, it goes the opposite extreme and says he lawfully knew their trade secrets. There's no evidence that he improperly disclosed it to any third party. So it does come down to improper use. And in this case, TAG had complete access, all the files, all the working papers and so on, that Mr. Bircher had from the period that he was competing with TAG. And so it should have been a simple matter of saying, here's what we contend to be a trade secret, whether that's the review guideline for when there's been an unbundling of this particular test or whatever it might be. And here's where we see Mr. Bircher applying that in his working papers when he competed. There is none of that evidence in this case, and that's why Tagg argued at trial that the trial court should infer that it was inevitable that Mr. Bircher would use trade secrets, and that's why the Tagg was citing the PepsiCo case and why the trial court relied on it.
When you say they had the working papers, are you talking about specific assignments? I'm forgetting now the name of the big client that came over. Did they have the work papers that your guy did for that work for that client?
Exactly. My client was doing work for Presidio. He was contacted by Presidio right after he left Tagg and asked to do their big claims. He was my client's a former CPA, and I think the testimony trial was undisputed that he's excellent at these larger claims. And Presidio very much wanted him to be working on them. So Presidio contacted him. He had, I think, about a dozen or so different files that he was working on for Presidio. And after the preliminary injunction came down, he transferred those files to Tagg and had Tagg finish up the work on them. And so Tagg had complete discovery of everything that my client was doing when it was competing, or when he was competing. So it should not have been difficult, had there been use of a trade secret, to have said, here's how he used a trade secret. They had the complete picture, and it shouldn't have required any kind of an admission from my client that, yes, I used trade secrets or didn't. The inference that's been drawn here under this inevitable disclosure theory flips the burden of proof from the employer to show use of a trade secret onto the employee to prove the negative, that he didn't use the trade secret. That's part of the problem with the inference that's being drawn here. And I think part of the gestalt of this argument is, and I will say it's not without some common sense appeal, but the idea is somebody who's worked and who has had access and knows the trade secrets can't but help but think about them or remember them subconsciously or consciously when they start to compete. But the Uniform Trade Secrets Act prohibits use of the trade secret, not thinking about a trade secret or remembering it. And I think that's really the theory behind the inevitable disclosure doctrine. It's one way or the other. This employee can't help but think about it unless they're able to compartmentalize their brain and shut off the trade secret. That's the idea behind the theory, but the theory just goes too far in interpreting the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, I think, in preventing competition by departing employees. It goes too far in doing an end run around the Colorado General Assembly's decision to allow for covenants not to compete that are narrowly tailored in time and geographic limit. Ironically, and of course there was a Tagg did try to enforce a covenant not to compete that my client never signed. Ironically, my client would be much better off had he signed that covenant not to compete rather than having this inference that he must be misappropriating trade secrets if he competes, because the covenant not to compete would have to be limited in time and geographic scope. This inference prohibits my client from competing anywhere in the world permanently, because if we were to go back in front of the trial court, all Tagg would have to say is, Your Honor, Mr. Bircher is competing again, and the trial court could say, well, I am inferring then that he must be using Tagg's trade secrets, whether or not there's direct proof of that. I think we've gone most of the way through many of the points that I would have raised. The other thing that I do want to hit, though, is that the injunction, even if the court affirms the trial court's decision that my client misappropriated trade secrets, the injunction is simply too broad in this case. The cases that Tagg has cited, I think, more support our position than they support Tagg's position. All of those cases stand for the proposition that an injunction that actually does identify the trade secret can be enforced, and an injunction that doesn't, with some specificity, identify what is to be enjoined cannot be enforced. Rule 65D is not optional in its application. In this case, we have an injunction that says my client's prohibited from using Tagg's trade secrets, but then it goes on to define the trade secrets in general terms like software programs. I mentioned the HANS program that TAG has, and clearly my client couldn't use the HANS program. We know that. But TAG also uses things like Microsoft Excel, Microsoft Word, Microsoft Outlook, programs that we all have on our computers. Would that mean that my client couldn't use those software programs if he went into competition? The line's not clear there. Another thing is data sources. One of the key data sources, if you're reviewing a hospital bill, is obviously the hospital bill review or the hospital bill itself, and then a form that is always accompanying the hospital bill. TAG uses those, of course, as would anybody reviewing the hospital bill. Is that a data source that my client can't use? We proposed an injunction that I think respectfully tracks the evidence that TAG presented at trial and said, if there's going to be an injunction, here's what it should look like. Here are the exhibits that were admitted in evidence that dealt with TAG's trade secrets, and these should be identified as the trade secrets, these documents, and then the information contained therein. And instead, what we have is an injunction that is so broad that I would submit none of us in this room could tell what exactly is prohibited without having a mini trial to go further into what's actually a trade secret or not.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Holm, appearing on behalf of the Appellee, the Assist Group. Mr. Bircher's counsel argues that this is really a Pepsi case and that the basis upon which the trial judge ruled is that they're allowed by that case to make an inference of use of trade secrets. I gather from the court's remarks that the court understands some of our issues, and I beg the court's indulgence to let me review some of the facts, the key salient facts that show that Pepsi really is not applicable and is not the basis of the court's decision in this case. First, Mr. Bircher was hired by the Assist Group, which I may refer to as TAG, in 2002. At that time, his background was as a certified public accountant, and he had served a number of years as a third-party administrator. Those are people who administer payment of hospital and doctor bills on behalf of self-insured companies. He had, at that time, never performed a review of a hospital bill. He starts work for TAG. Works for them for 8 years in capacities as a chief operating officer and executive vice president, and develops over that time by trial and error processes and reviews and procedures for reviewing hospital bills and for negotiating reductions in those bills so that their clients don't have to pay as much. Mr. Bircher's paid over $200,000 a year for this work, a total of some $2 million by the time he leaves. Not until 2007 is there any effort to start commemorating these procedures and policies that Mr. Bircher's developed in writing. And it's only at that time that they start producing them in writing, and indeed they haven't completed that task yet. But ultimately, Mr. Bircher's trade secrets and the development of that through, and also the development with other people who then join TAG, was to call for a reduction in a savings to the clients of TAG of some 20% on each of these bills that gets average of 20% on these bills that get produced to it, as distinct from the average production of most of the other bill reviewers in the country of 3 to 5%. Now, this difference, dramatic as it is important and valuable to TAG because TAG gets paid on the basis of a percentage of the savings that they acquire for their patients. Also during this time, because of the development of these trade secrets, the speed with which bills could be reviewed increases phenomenally. During the first year or two that Mr. Bircher is doing this, they do 5 to 10 bill reviews a year. By the time he leaves, they're doing 150 to 200 a month. This is because of the systems that they've developed, policies and practices and methods that allow them to go through and review these bills so efficiently and so quickly to get this magnitude of savings? Mr. Bircher tells the new employees, these are trade secrets. We don't even share them with our clients. We don't want to teach them how to fish. We don't want them to learn our trade secrets and do it themselves. The learning of these processes, when they teach them to the new employees, takes 6 to 9 months of study and training and experience before they're effective at it. They all sign confidentiality agreements, and there is a confidentiality agreement in Mr. Bircher's employment agreement to preserve the trade secrets. And in May of 2010, Mr. Bircher tells one of TAG's consultants, no one else does this. 3 months later, Mr. Bircher leaves TAG, and 3 days later, he produces for TAG's biggest client, Presidio Reinsurance, a proposal for how he can review their hospital bills that when he goes through and reviews it, and when we go through and review it in trial, virtually every single item on there, 3 pages worth, is stuff that he was doing at TAG.
Can you address that more specifically, Mr. Holman? And I do appreciate the background. It's helpful to me, at least. Mr. Polkerbeck says you had all the work papers, and so if you had them, and I guess the suggestion is you didn't point to specific trade secrets that Mr. Bircher misappropriated. It sounds to me like you think otherwise, and I'd be curious about that. And I guess related to that, if you had all the specifics, why is the court talking about inferences as opposed to pointing to specific?
Well, because the approach that Mr. Bircher took was, you've got to show that I took documents. I took specific documents and I used them in this way. As far as we know, he didn't. He's testified he didn't. We didn't have any basis for checking that. He's the only one who's working by himself. Our concern is, he's got 8 years worth of information that we've paid $2 million to plant in his brain, and he walks out and 3 days later comes up with exactly the same process. 2 weeks later, actually performs a completed bill review.
Excuse me for interrupting you. Is that you say completed the same process? I mean, it's one thing to, and then you said he did a bill review. Well, the bill review is not going to get you there, but he had to use these trade secrets. What evidence was there that he used the trade secrets he took with him?
The evidence was, and of course, again, since he didn't take specific documents, we can't line them up and just say, okay, well, I mean, we could a couple of times, but not all the time. But when he was ordered to turn over all of the documents for the accounts he had been working on after he'd been preliminarily enjoined from doing so, he continued to do it. In fact, he was held in contempt for doing it. He turns over all those documents, and one of our witnesses, Larry Ast, reviewed those documents and testified specifically that virtually all of them looked like what TAG was doing and used the same processes. That when he talked to Mr. Bircher about the negotiation processes that Mr. Bircher were using were virtually identical to those which were used by TAG. And now Mr. Polkerbeck says, well, the only thing they were talking about was Exhibit N. Well, that's not what was being talked about by Mr. Ast. He was talking about reviewing lots of the documents that were there. Did we put them all into evidence? No, we didn't put them all into evidence. We had testimony that was not denied to the extent that they were being used the same way. Let me see if I can find it here quickly. Mr. Ast is talking about reviewing the list of all of the different accounts that had been turned over to him, and after saying it's an accurate list, the question is, I think you indicated, but let me be clear, that you've reviewed the documents Mr. Bircher sent to TAG with respect to these claims. I have. Have you been able to look at them for signs of whether or not Mr. Bircher used any of TAG's trade secrets in reviewing these claims? I have. What have you found? The documents that I reviewed are, to my knowledge, based my review of them, almost duplicates the same work product that we had with the assist group. They have different names on them and some whistles and bells, but 99% of the document is exactly the same as the work product we have. And that testimony was not exhibit N. That was all the documents that he had reviewed. So, yes, there is a showing that they've done it the same way. And indeed, following the proposal 3 days after he had left TAG and gone over to his own Fiera, his own business. In addition to that, then in December and January and February and April, I may have missed one of those months, he was being asked additional questions by Presidio. Can you do this? Can you do this? In every single case, it was stuff that TAG did. And he said yes and helped them do it.
Strong, can I just ask you, you read from a witness, what was the witness's name again? I apologize.
Asked,
thank you.
AST, and that was from, I think, the transcript of June 28, and I was reading from pages 68 and 69.
Thank you very much.
Tellingly, on this proposal that he submitted to Presidio 3 days after he left TAG, he, on that proposal, the written proposal, includes the words confidential and proprietary. In short, he didn't think that what he had on there was information readily available to the public. He thought there was something unique there. The only place he could have gotten anything unique was from TAG.
Well, unless, of course, he invented something entirely new on his own, right?
In 3 days, which took 6 to 9 months for other people to learn. And indeed, there was no evidence, no suggestion that he had done this because he used computer programs from someplace else. There are lots of computer programs out there. They get 3 to 5%. He had testified that there were 3 or 4 different companies that also got 20%. He didn't say, I used their processes. He probably would have had trouble doing that because all of those companies treat their processes as trade secrets. So in any event, circumstantial evidence does play a part here, and you've got the trial court finding that, in fact, he was using these trade secrets, and he has not claimed that there's no evidence to support that other than, well, we can't prove that he took the specific pieces of paper or the electronic versions of those documents.
I may interrupt one more time, Mr.
Of course.
Would you address more specifically why this is not a PepsiCo case?
Well, it's because we're not having to rely on some vague inference about in PepsiCo. The problem was, of course, that they were enjoining the person from going to work for another company. He hadn't done anything yet. He'd been hired, and they wanted to enjoin him now so that he wouldn't be able to use what was in his brain. Here, we've got not only the fact that 3 days later he's producing an identical product and then violates the injunction and produces more of these identical products and then turns over the documents and we look at them and they are virtually identical to TAG. That's simply circumstantial evidence to the effect that he was in fact using them. It's not some sort of, well, we'll think maybe he shouldn't use them in the future. He's proven that he would use them and use them in violation of an injunction.
So in other words, your interpretation when the court said I can infer based on X, Y, and Z is the court was really talking about the circumstantial evidence.
I think that's the only way it can possibly be read,
right.
Particularly given how little emphasis the court paid. And I mean, when you look at the case, the court's talking about a lot of Colorado cases that look at the arguments that were originally being made, which was, well, this all information is in the public domain. Look, everybody knows about hospital reviews. Everybody knows about unbundling. Everybody knows that Medicare documents are out there. That's just the same stuff. What they didn't know, what is kept as the trade secret, what's the X, as he asks in one of his briefs? The X is the recipe. The X is how do you do this? Which of this volume of documents do you look at as being really crucial to get through it? The end result of the trial and error. Now we have the recipe. It's the Coca-Cola formula. Is there anything in the Coca-Cola that's not known to the public at large? Of course not. Everything has to be known to the public at large because it wouldn't be approved otherwise. What isn't known is what percentages of each of these things you use and how you get to where you end up. So that's what we're concerned about with respect to the trade secrets.
Mr. Holm, can I ask you before your time runs out, would you address the issue Mr. Pokorek raises about the breadth of the injunction?
Yes.
I will tell you, he raises some pretty good points when you talk about software programs and analytics, data sources, workflows.
The it doesn't prohibit them from using software programs. It doesn't prohibit them from using Excel. What it prohibits them from doing is using TAG's trade secrets. It's the program that TAG devised that allows them to decide which of the aspects you include. Everybody can use Excel. We're not asking them to do that. Everyone can look at the hospital records. It's how you sort out those hospital records so you get to the attachment to Exhibit N, which is a list of 10 or 20 or 30 pages of specific items from the hospital bill that get called out. And it's how you get there that does it. So these are TAG's trade secrets. This is not like the cases he cites, which are an injunction against, quote, trade secrets, those two words, quote, confidential information and trade secrets, those five words. It's not a situation of saying we're going to enjoin things that are similar to. Therefore, what's similar to, these are injunctions against TAG's trade secrets.
Counsel, the language of the injunction, though, is broader than that. It says, TAG secrets consist of, and then it says, using computerized algorithms. It doesn't say TAG's algorithms. It doesn't say TAG software.
Except that it does start by saying TAG's trade secrets. And the computerized algorithms, as was testified to during the trial, are TAG's algorithms. I mean, he can use other algorithms. There's nothing that stops him from turning on his computer. It is those aspects of the software of the hospital bills that are under TAG's processes, methods, procedures used by TAG.
Mr. Holm, your time is.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the court's time.
Counsel, the oral arguments are now over. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This concludes our oral arguments for today. Counsel, please drive safely home.